Welcome to episode 240 of Five and Dive. It is Tuesday, September 13th. I'm your host, Craig Goldstein, editor-in-chief of Baseball Prospectus. Joining me as my co-host today, Jeffrey Paternostro, lead prospect writer for Baseball Prospectus. Jeffrey, I can only assume after our in-depth discussion of whether Harry Styles spit on Chris Pine, you tuned into the Emmys last night. I have no idea what happened. I'm kidding.
I'm aware that Bob Odenkirk didn't win for Better Call Saul. That's all I know.
Yeah, I also know that Abbott Elementary did quite well. That's about all I know. That's all
I want to watch
on the current events.
If I want to watch a 3.5 hour broadcast featuring too much talking and stars past their prime, I'll just watch a Yankees Red Sox game on Sunday Night Baseball.
Hey-o! I was just wondering which team you were going to dunk on, because it applies to, I don't know, enough of them. Anyway, do you have any topics before we get into the show?
I have some good news, an important seltzer update over here. I went to a different grocery store, which is apparently owned.
Yeah, Bolt.
There's two fairly close to me. It's apparently owned by Kroger's.
Mm-hmm.
A proper dominant, east of the Mississippi River. Yeah, but they have Polar.
Sure.
I can get Polar out here now. It's very exciting. I am actually finishing up the last of my Guava Sao Paulo LaCroix right now, but I'm very excited to.
Yeah, I don't.
It's love... not. It's very subtle.
It's fine.
I need a little more guava.
Yeah, I would like, which is, again, I normally am not always asking for more.
But it's a very soft flavor, right? In general, guava. So you want a little more, yeah. It doesn't have citrus bite to it.
It's totally fine. Like you can drink it. It's nice. It's just, you're hardly getting anything. Yeah, right. I agree. All right. Well, with that out of the way, we should move on to our first topic. Weights and measures. We've got a whole slew of new rules coming.
They're new to you, maybe, Craig.
Yeah, fair enough.
I've been dealing with them for years.
I guess I'm very interested in your take on this, having experienced a variety of these. Have you experienced
everything,
all of these rules?
Yeah, because they did, I think, bring the only. I don't believe they don't have. They didn't have the step off rule at triple at double A, but they did have the two pickoffs or whatever.
Oh, right. It was just a throwover and not a step up, a disengagement, if you will.
Yeah.
So where do you want to start? Pitch clock?
Pitch clock seems to get, I think pitch clock is actually the least important here, but it is getting the most attention, I think, outside of maybe shifting too. But yeah, it's me 15 and 20. It's 14 and 18 in the minors. So my impression here is it will make games go faster, although I don't think as fast. I don't think you'll see as great dip in game time. I think pitchers, especially more experienced pitchers, are going to use all those 18 seconds. Max Scherzer is already out there saying, I'm going to find every way to manipulate this I possibly can. And I think a lot of the veteran pitchers will do that as well. I do wonder, are they just starting this in
2023?
Like from day one? I mean, but from like day one, they're not even giving them like a month with no,
I don't think so.
But just warnings and stuff like training. They've done.
I think it's going to be in spring training. I think. So my only comment on what Max Scherzer said. So I agree with you, and I think people have said this. Observers who have seen the minors, the older pitchers, do take more of a clock.
That's what I've seen in AAA. Is like I do find the pitchers are going taking it all the way down to zero.
Only thought on that is that at least with runners on, you're easier to time. Right. So like there is an incentive not to just drain it, but to at least have, run it down within 2 to 3 seconds instead of all the way down to one. Because if you go down to zero, basically, a runner can take off. Now, maybe that it depends on who the runner is. It depends on, a variety of things. But you put it in concert with a bunch of these with some of these other rules, and it does seem like that might be a factor.
Yeah, I don't think it's going to have a huge outsized impact on the pitchers having to conserve energy. I've not seen guys have a problem ramping up every 18 seconds, 14 seconds, whatever. So I don't, I don't know if there's going to be effects or like guys that are used to taking more time going to, more prone to command issues or injury arm problems. I don't know, but I haven't seen at least any indication over the last couple of years that pitchers can't still max out every 20 seconds or so.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I wonder what the cumulative effect of that, like if you're maxing out, but it's not as, you know, if your normal max out is 98, if suddenly it's 96.7 or whatever. Like, sure. I don't know. I do think, like, again, cumulatively, that type of thing will come into play. Now, maybe, you know, you've seen it. Maybe it won't, but for guys, there is research that says like the guys who throw harder tend to take longer between pitches. So I guess I tend to think like it will have some effects, but I don't know what that effect is.
Yeah. I mean, I think at a certain point, like one of the things about this rule is you don't even really notice it unless there's auto ball, auto strike calls, which I probably saw half dozen this year, maybe. You know, pitchers adapted pretty quickly.
Right. So I agree we're not going to see in some lower minor leagues it's like 23 minutes.
No, I think you'll see like 10-15 minutes off.
Yeah, and field, I think which that's is not pretty valuable. I also think like it's not even time of game. I mean, this the reason people call these less, pace of play initiatives
it's dead is space, right? Yeah.
Even if
guys are still striking out at a huge clip, at least there's like more stuff happening.
Right. It moves a little faster. I mean, do you notice that at the minor league level that it's not?
So it's funny. I was the first game I went to last week was kind of sloggy for the first four or five innings, like a lot of deep counts, foul balls, runners on. And I looked up after four innings and it had only been like an hour 10.
Mm-hmm.
Then the bullpen's got in, it got way worse, but it like you don't well, even
minor when, league baseball.
Yeah. Even when it's not, yeah. Oliver Ortega just throwing 95 and getting knocked all around the park for 20 minutes. Yeah. Even when it feels kind of sloggy, I mean, the actual like at bat feels kind of sloggy, but it's not taking as much time.
Mm-hmm.
And it, again, it's like shaving a couple seconds off each pitch. You may not notice
there are a lot of pitches, but it adds up. Yeah. I mean, that's
there are a lot of pitches these days, Craig. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I do think that's I'm a big fan of this initiative, whatever you want to call it.
Sure.
I don't know that it'll fix everything, but I don't think it hurts. And I think we've seen in the minor league that it really doesn't. It doesn't hurt in the ways that people might be worried about. I appreciate the concern over injuries. I'm sure there are some injuries related to this. I guess my counterpoint is like, we haven't stopped injuries in any other capacity. It doesn't seem to be slowing down anything in baseball except the pace of play.
I will say that like 10 to 14 seconds between pitches can be occasionally annoying to me when I'm trying to take notes.
Right. You'd like a little more time.
Sure. Yeah. To scribble down my shorthand. Yeah. But it's fine.
Yeah. I was trying to find like a pace leaderboard because I was trying to see who, now that Pedro Baez isn't here, like who is the archetype for
it might guy literally be Chris week. Bassett. He takes forever between pitches.
Yeah. So I think this kind of thing is to an overall benefit, but I agree. It's I don't know. It like you're saying, like it's getting the most attention, but probably isn't that big a deal. But I do think like, again, for the pace of things, it is a big deal. And you've talked about going to games and coming back after two and a half hours. That's
Craig,
nice.
Craig, in two clicks, I found your pace leaderboard for this year. Okay. So.
Well, I don't know what I did.
Giovanni Gallegos, 26 seconds. 26.1 seconds. Kenley Jansen is 26.
Okay. Kenley.
So there at the top. I'm just looking at how many pitchers there are over 20. There are 111 pitchers that take 20 seconds or more on average. And lots of some really good pitchers here. You know, Verlander's 20 flat. Nola's a little over 20. Scroll a little up. Let's see, like, get into like the 22s and 23. I mean, it's a lot of relievers. You know, it's a lot of like max effort relievers.
Sounds like mostly relievers.
Alexis Diaz, Taylor Rogers, Camilo Doval, Rasmo Ramirez, who does not throw hard for some reason, is here. You know, Josh Hader, J.R. Familia, Joe Kelly, 23 seconds. The fastest This is bases empty, by the way. This is not runners on base.
Oh, okay.
I did not realize that when I clicked on it. I think it's probably broadly the same, but I'm trying to see who, like, the starting notable starting. These are all relievers. It looks like the slowest starting pitcher with nobody on base is, I don't think I missed anybody. It's a tie between Tyler McGill and Shohei Ohtani at 21.4 seconds.
So they're the slowest starters. Yeah.
They're going to have to shave some time off there. With runners on. Yeah. With runners on, Giovanni Gallegos takes 31.6 seconds between pitches.
Jesus. That's staggering. So he's going to get 20 seconds?
Yeah. There's some funny ones. So Frankie Montas, 18.6 with nobody on, 27.9 with runners on base.
Oh my God.
So you have some guys with like a big, fairly big gap here. Like, I mean, Gallegos and Jansen. And Gallegos is like, Gallegos is just in like 5 seconds. Like some of the starters, especially Josiah Gray, goes from 19.8 to 27.5.
Good Lord.
Luis Garcia goes from 21 to 27.2. So yeah, there's gonna be some adjustment for some of these pitchers. If you want the fastest working guy is also a reliever, interestingly enough. Or Sam Long starting for the Giants.
Now, mostly relievers.
Yeah. The fastest starter is Cole Irvin, 14 seconds between
the pitches. Cole Irvin gets the Mark Burley award. Yeah, no. So, I mean, I think all in all, that's going to be, I do think it's going to be a big positive. I don't know if it'll change much other than just, again, like how we experience the pace of the game. But like, I still think that's a big, big thing. You want to do the shift next?
I will just say before we move on from this,
yes.
Only 25 pitchers with the bases empty are under 15 seconds or less this year. So.
Well, and you said they're going to get, it's 15 and 20.
Those, 15
that's
and 20.
Yeah. So that's going to be a substantial change for a lot of people.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I don't think I don't know. I saw a clip today of Joey Votto being interviewed for a podcast at The Athletic. Jason Stark and Doug Glanville were talking to him. And he basically, they said, like, you're one of the slowest batters.
Mm-hmm.
And he basically was like, make it 10 seconds. Like, I don't care. Like, I will, it's the time that's afforded to me and I use it, but like, I'll be fine. Yeah. And I kind of think that's the way, you know, like, look, it doesn't surprise you. I guess we should note that the players on the committee that passed this rule voted against it.
Yeah.
That doesn't surprise me. People don't like change. Pitchers, I think get in, you know, they like their habits. They don't want to have to change anything up. They don't want to potentially screw anything up. I'm understanding of that. I'm very pro player, whatever. Yeah. Like, too bad. I think this is important.
I agree.
They're not against it in total either.
And like the other thing is the league's never going to shave 15 seconds off the commercial breaks, which would have the same effect.
Which would be great. And then frankly, they should do both. But
right.
But the commercial breaks aren't impacting the time. I mean, like, to that Grant Brisby article where it's like it really was like guys stepping out of the box. I'm glad they have we've been talking about the pitcher aspects of this, but like there are batter penalties too.
Yes. Yeah,
and you have to be ready, you have to be in the box, or you're gonna get penalized for it. And that's good. I think I am sympathetic to the players who said basically they suggested kind of having a relaxed version of this in late and close or like late game situations, big moments, whatever you want to call it. I'm sympathetic to it to some degree. Like I think that's fine. I think basically umpires should understand the moment and not do like ticky, you know, it's a little like basketball refs in a lot of ways, like last 2 minutes of a game, they're not calling,
or like NFL,
not
delay,
always calling
NFL delay of game shit. Where you got to look up and see the clock at zero and look back down and make sure they haven't started their delivery or whatever, which actually gives them an extra second probably.
Right. And it's like, it's fine. Like you don't need to call the ticky tack shit in a big moment. And I frankly hope umpires don't.
Right.
But
the minor league umpires got graded on this. So they had to be very, and it was getting logged by the stringer. So they had to call it completely.
Well, and I want to look, I'm saying I'd be fine with that, but I also like it's all in the player's control.
Yeah.
Too. Do you know what I mean? Like they get in the box and it's not a problem. And like I saw this when it was discussed, people, a game ended, I think, on a on a strikeout that was called because the batter didn't get in the box in time. And people said, you can't do this at the major league level. And you sure as shit can.
Yeah,
it's that can't happen. Guys are gonna and no one else will fuck it up.
Yeah, it's like Wilmer Flores getting rung up on the check swing that wasn't a check swing, like
absolutely,
or that was a check swing, if you prefer. Yeah, yeah,
right, right.
Like, right. That's yeah. I mean, the rule's the rule.
Well, but that's also one that's like completely up to interpretation. I guess I agree with you. It wasn't sure, a swing, right. This is like either you're in the box or you're not. And I guess the point is, like, if you're not in the box in a big moment, call timeout, which you're allowed to do.
Yeah.
Call timeout. Number one, if you need to take a moment to collect yourself, do that first and foremost. Secondly, like, if you're not in the box and someone in a game ends on it in a big situation, the next time someone comes up in a big situation, they're going to be very aware of it. And they're either going to call timeout or they're going to get in the box.
From the pitcher point of view, you can step off. I believe it counts as a pickoff if you do, but
it's a disengagement.
Disengagement. Right. Sorry.
Correct. Correct. It's a disengagement. And you can also call timeout. Yeah. Like, you can also call for time, and you can do that once per, I think per plate appearance.
I believe so. Yeah.
So, look, I understand that there's a lot kind of going on here, but like, this is not, again, I think the stuff on the batters is just as important as the pitchers. Yeah, there is a ton of guys. And that's
like the balancing effect too. The guy can't, absolutely. The guy's got to, if you got to be in the box and the pitcher wants to use his whole time, you got to stand there for 10 seconds and just get cold, basically.
Yeah, well, sure. But, you know, I think that, again, like, when I watch these games and a guy takes a ball an inch or two off the plate or whatever, and then steps out, even if it's 1 foot, like steps out.
Are we going to lose the Soto shuffle out of this?
I don't think so. He's pretty fast. I mean, like, I'm just saying, like, that kind of stuff, like, you didn't even swing, man. Like, you don't need to step out of the box. And look, I understand this is all, there's a mental preparation, like, set yourself, whatever, go through the same checklist, be ready. But like, you're just going to have a different version of this. And by the way, we've seen this in other sports. Tennis has a serve clock now. Yeah. Rafael Nadal famously took four fucking ever. He still takes forever, but he has to do it within the clock. Mm-hmm. And he does, you know, I don't know if I said he looks like a cat when he's going to, he does like a shirt pull on each side. He wipes something from his cheek. He rubs his wrist thing on his nose. Like, it is like, it's an extensive thing. It's comparable to like Nomar's glove, you know, tightening and checking. He does it within the time allotted. Yep. That's
a jest.
And these guys will be able to do that. And guess what? He's still one of the best tennis players in the world. Mm-hmm. So like, it's fine. Like, you're going to be fine. So the shift, let's talk about the shift.
Yes. So this is pretty close to what the AA rule, where it's like all feet on the dirt. Basically, you can't do the,
all four infielders must have their feet on the dirt, right? Yeah.
I don't think this.
You also have to have two designated on each side.
Sure, I don't. Like,
you can't cross the midpoint line, which I think is also in at least one of the minor leagues.
Yeah, AA, you can put as many on the either side as you want, but they have to all be on the dirt. I think in the lower minors, it's 2 inches or whatever. They have the box out rule that they were playing around with in the Florida State League. I don't think this is going to have a huge effect. Obviously, Rob Arthur wrote about that at the site at the end of last week. You're going to get, is like Dan Vogelbach going to rip a few more singles?
Yes.
In their right field? Yes. Good for Dan Vogelbach.
So my take on this, Patrick and I also wrote kind of a brief kind of rundown of this thing. It was not as in-depth as Rob's article, which also heavily referenced Russell Carlton's work on the shift, which the guy wrote a book on it. Yeah. Buy the book, read the articles, always read Russell. But my take on this is it's not bad. And I've kind of slowly evolved my thoughts on, I used to hate kind of the idea of banning the shift because I thought it was stupid. And I still kind of think it's stupid. I just mostly think it's inconsequential now. I think it's stupid in the sense that if you're a league that's trying to address three true outcome offensive approach, this does nothing in that vein.
This encourages you to rip pull side even more as a left-handed power hitter, because hey, if you don't get it square, you've got a lot more space to shoot for now.
Yeah. Exactly. So I guess I should caveat that it does address it in the sense that a single is not one of the three true outcomes.
Sure.
Whereas an out is, and that by hitting into the shift with those miss hits, while you're selling out for full pull side power as a lefty, you're committing one of the three true outcomes. Whereas a single isn't. But you're also encouraged, the incentive is to keep doing that because and keep selling out for power, as you pointed out, if you're Dan Vogelback, because you're going to get a few more singles because of how these guys are placed and no longer allowed to be placed. The other part is it really is only a few more because most of these shifts, and this was in Rob's article, is a softer shift. It's not the three guys on one side of the bag, or if they are on one side of the bag, like the one guy is mostly up the middle, he'll be a few steps over, probably not going to impact things a ton.
This is like the mental disconnect too, right? We see a hitter rip one back up the middle and think it's a sure base hit, and the shortstop or second baseman are just standing there and it's a 6-3 or a 4-3 or a double play or whatever. Yeah.
And those are still going to happen.
Yeah.
And it was interesting. I had a conversation with someone that basically they said, like, it's about like that, you know, a ripped shot up the box was a single for 140 years. And it's about making sure that's happened. And it's like, well, okay, but it never had to be, right? Like, you could always, over the history of baseball, position your guys there. They just didn't. And to me, like, the drastic change here is that you're now mandating where guys are allowed to stand, which has not been the case outside of like pitcher, catcher, and the first baseman gets a special glove. You know what I mean? Like, that just has not generally been the case in baseball that you have to stand in a specific area.
Going back to the idea that the shifting is this, like,
I mean, they've been doing it since the beginning of the game.
Nerd shit from the last 7 years or whatever. Yeah, I forget who the outfielder was. I remember reading one of the Bill James historical abstracts. He just like come in against certain hitters and play as a fifth infielder, which is why his like total zone was bizarre or something.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So yeah, this has always been done.
Yeah, and not to this degree, and I understand that. But I tend to think my philosophical disagreement is that I think the defense should be able to set up how they want.
Yeah. And the funny thing is like
I also don't think it really matters in this case. Like, I'm not going to enjoy, like, my experience of baseball is not going to be lessened because Dan Vogelback gets a few more singles and Max Muncy gets a few more singles and guys like that. I actually, like, I might even enjoy it more, and I'm willing, like, that is there's some cognitive dissonance there, but like, philosophically, I think defenses should be able to impact the game the way they are. Mm-hmm. But aesthetically, I might actually enjoy the fact that they can't. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I should point out as a caveat, because I did do the two clicks to find the pitch tempo. They did not read the note at the top of the pitch tempo.
Okay.
Which says it is not measuring the same thing as the MLB pitch timer. It is measuring time between pitches, and the clock doesn't actually start until the pitcher gets the ball back.
Right. Right. So it is a little different, but still, yeah.
It's not as egregious as, it's not as large an adjustment as the raw tempo stats indicate.
Sure. But yeah, so for the shift, I don't think, I don't know. I've also seen a lot of talk of like, our team's going to send a guy running, you know, start him running. You might see it, but no. I don't think they're going to do that. I don't think that's going to help defensive.
Yeah. The thing that's interesting to me is, again, this is a fairly, outside of getting rid of the Ted Williams shift, like specifically, this is a fairly nuanced change in terms of defensive alignments. But I do wonder now if someone like Francisco Lindor, who's, you know, given quotes before that he's anti-shift. And I don't think he's anti-shift. Like, he stands where they tell him to stand, but he thinks he can just start in a standard alignment and make plays anyway, which maybe he can. But I do wonder if in these sort of these more standard alignments, if the value of truly great, first step in range guys will go up. Like Lindor,
I think so.
It's going to lower the baseline for average shortstop defense, because you can't have Johnny Peralta standing perfectly placed where he only has to move a couple of feet right. to his left or his right. I mean, the counterpoint to that is teams might start valuing those kind of shortstop defenders more, and the average baseline might actually go up. But I think in the short term, you might actually see increased defensive value from your truly elite defenders.
Yeah, I think that's right. But I think it really has to be the elite of the elite, because again, like, there aren't the number of times there is a real true overshift is a lot less than people think.
Right.
And so like, I think someone like Corey Seager, like, could this hasten his move off short? Maybe, but he's also mostly going to be able to stand in the places that they had him stand, you know, by and large. So I think it's definitely possible, but I guess at this point, I'd be surprised if it's a huge factor for someone like that. But I agree with you that like the real top guys in terms of first step reaction and overall range are going to, I don't know if they're going to like see a benefit, but their teams will see the benefit of those skills, I guess, is the best way to phrase it. I will also note that people talked about how infields actually can be shaped differently and are shaped differently. Right now, there are rules coming in with this set of changes that govern how far back you can set the dirt, how far front, you know, it's a pretty, they're tightening the amount of variability that infields can see right now. So you're not going to see any team like set up their infield dirt very far back, allowing their infield to play further back than anyone else or anything like that. I think it's like a total of 2 feet. It's like it has to be between 94 and 96 feet or something like that. So you're just not going to see that kind of change. Because teams would probably gain
if they didn't
tighten that
again. Everyone's going to try to, when we say everyone's going to adjust to this, everyone is going to then push it as far as they possibly can within the constraints of the role, because
absolutely. And the last thing on the shift, unless you have anything else to say, is that Mike Petriello had an interesting thread kind of pointing out that like you can still essentially do the three infield, or sorry, it's not three, you can do an overshift. You're just going to do it with your outfielders now. And essentially risk, if a ball does go to the left-hand side into the outfield, it's extra bases instead of a single. Now I do think
might not be for Dan Vogelbach.
right, good point, but I do think that changes the calculation.
I think
basically saying if we limit this guy to a single, that's a win, was a huge portion of the strategy here. That like, even if he beats us, his win is a single. If that becomes a double, I do think that changes the calculation and will be enough for teams not to do this kind of outfield overshift that results in kind of the same setup as before. But it is possible, I guess, it's worth pointing out that teams can still
are the Rays at some point going to play Manny Margot like 90 feet short of the infield dirt? Entirely possible.
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess the other thing here is that you definitely cannot have four man outfields because the infielders need to
have five man infields.
Well, you could essentially bring the center fielder.
Yeah, I mean, I guess you would just have to stand on the grass.
Dirt, I think. I think guys like Joe, you know, we didn't mention Joey Gallo. Joey Gallo probably really does benefit from something like this, especially given how hard he hits it and that kind of thing. So that's that on the shift. Pickoff rule. Let's go with that.
Yeah, I hate this. This is the one I actually out now.
I also really don't like it.
The constant stolen bases are going to be like very disruptive to my enjoyment of the game. It's aesthetically, I don't like it. I know a lot of people like the 80s Cardinals or whatever, like a single's a double. I just think this opens up the game to stolen base, like just a constant stolen bases. It's going to radically rechange the catcher position.
Yeah.
Especially potentially in concert with ABS as well. So I think this is going to have like major knock-on effects. Like, I don't think it's going to be, like, we're seeing guys like 60, 70 stolen bases in the Florida State League this year, like guys that are not fast, but
Well, that's a little bit of the joke. I mean, like, are you opposed to guys stealing 60 and 70 stolen bases? I mean, like,
no, not particularly, but I'm just, I think the constant amount of running with guys on is going to be annoying. I don't think it's going to be as bad because the, you know, the pitchers in the Florida State League don't know how to hold runners generally. So they just would not throw over in a lot of cases. Catchers
are not as good.
Catchers are not as good. Yep. So I think teams are going to be a little less aggressive than maybe in the minors. But I do think it's just aesthetically, I do not enjoy it. I don't have a problem with a pickoff rule per se, but it'd be like four instead of two, I think. Because what you really want to do is get rid of the constant throwing over. No one throws over
four times either. I mean, that's the other... People will point that out about baseball as a thing they don't like, is like this nothing happens or, you know, whatever. But like, honestly, how many times do four pickoff or throws over happen in one at bat in a season? 10, 15?
Yeah.
Total?
It's going to be like those late and close situations with a guy on first and a slow closer. But isn't
that
a plate.
Little bit some of the game? Like, that's, I think those late and close, like if this happens in the playoff and a guy is throwing over, because you've got Terrence Gore, at first, and like then he finally runs. Like, to me, that's buildup, right? Yeah. Like, that's tension buildup. And I'm not saying I want it all the time. You're right. In the eighth inning of a 5-1 game in July, no, kill me. Like, I don't want that. But like,
I also kind of like, I enjoy the aesthetics of like the home crowd booing the road pitcher when he throws over. Like, it's kind of.
So I'm going to say, like, I slightly different. So I hate this rule philosophically. I wouldn't say I'm coming around to it, but I will admit, like, I don't know that it's going to bother me that guys are going to run, and I might actually like it. And so this is, again, another point of cognitive dissonance for me where, like, again, I think the pitcher should have this option in their tool belt. Like, they should be allowed to hold runners like this. Like, if you're already implementing the pitch clock. So Kenley Jansen's only defense against stolen bases, and it's not much of one, is he varies how long he takes to go to the plate, right? He is very slow, very methodical in his delivery and how long he takes to deliver the pitch. But part of the reason he takes so long is he's waiting out a runner in those situations and trying to vary how long, you know, or when he's going to start that very deliberative process. You've taken that away, right? Mm-hmm. But now he has a shitty pickoff move anyway. So it's not like he's really picking anyone off, but like, he can't even throw over a bunch of times to hold them. So like, I'm less worried. And look, as was my answer in some other things, I think people can reasonably say like, adapt or die. But Kenley Jansen is giving you second base if you get on base now. Like, he's not going to be able to throw over. You're going to time his delivery. He's going to take too long. And really, with like, he's a big guy with a lot of moving parts kind of to his delivery. If he speeds that up, like, he's going to lose something. We've seen him do slide step stuff. He loses a lot of velocity. He becomes an ineffective pitcher. Now,
I got news Braves, for you.
Braves fans are going to tell you he's an ineffective pitcher right now. He's been pretty good on the whole, you know, until this recent rough patch anyway. Like, I hear you on that. But I'm saying, like, you are legitimately changing his value. That's a real impact to Kenley Jansen and pitchers like Kenley Jansen. I'm not saying they shouldn't make the rule because of that, but I do think there's a real effect there. And I also, I mean, people will also, I saw a lot of people saying, oh, guys can just walk to second now after two pickoffs. Well, no, you like it. They can throw still over throw again. Over
there. It's a ball. If you don't get them. No.
It's a balk.
A balk. Sorry. Yes.
And the only reason I say it that way is I think it should be a ball.
Yeah.
I think if a pitcher wants to incur a ball penalty for throwing over an extra quote unquote time and keeping a guy close, that should be up to them.
Yeah.
I think a balk is really heavy-handed for this. I think
this is
penalty.
The most likely rule to be rescinded or significantly changed in
2024. I agree. And I was going to ask, did you see Darius Austin's piece today at BP? So Darius, one of our fantasy writers, writes really good research pieces that are not strictly about fantasy at all. And one thing I wanted to highlight is basically like, he basically applied some of the changes that happened in the minors to the major league setting and environment. And look, he says, like, you can't just straight do this because of what Jeff said. Better pickoff moves, better deliveries to the plate, better catchers, all this kind of stuff. But he said basically, like, you could see, like, dramatic changes to the number of stolen bases in baseball, which is essentially what you're saying without having read it, right? Like that the success rate is going to get pushed significantly higher above the break-even point, and thus teams are going to be incentivized to run with a lot more people. And like, to your point about your concern about it becoming annoying, I think there's a real possibility for that. And then, you know, you fold in the last thing, which I don't think we need to talk about a ton, but like these bigger bases, they shorten the time between bases a little bit, not much, sure. A little bit.
Sure.
But okay. But Jeff, like, you're rolling your eyes, and I only say that for the benefit of our listeners, but the amount of bang bang plays on stolen bases is pretty significant, right? Like, these guys are timed out between the delivery home, the pop time, and the speed of the runner.
That's just more base to pop off of for a split second that they can review.
Well, but it's also more base to hold on to, like, to slide across or whatever. So, like, I don't know. I'm just saying, I think you could see, I'm not predicting it, but I do allow the possibility that we could see a really, really big change in the number of stolen bases. Now, whether MLB considers that a win or a problem, I don't really know. I think I would lean towards win. That they want to see that. But I also do think, like you said, rescinded, I could at least see them saying, look, this is a ball instead of a balk. Because that's also more in line with, if stepping off is a disengagement, or if going over your pitch clock limit is a ball, why is throwing over an extra time significantly different than that? And a balk is a much bigger penalty with a man on base. So I could see that changing for sure. Anything else on the rule changes? I know we've gone long on it, but it's a big
set of stuff, changes. Yeah.
Anything else on that you'd like to mention? Okay. Let's go to our other big set of changes. Our second topic, minor threat. Every single person I know, when Rob Manfred, after announcing the changes to the rule set or what's going to be implemented in 2023, was asked a question and basically said, yeah, we plan on voluntarily recognizing the minor league unionization effort. And every single person I know said, wait, what the fuck? And what is he up to? Like, what's the other shoe here? But I think, and look, maybe I'm naive, but I think the other shoe is they're boxed in.
Right.
They don't have.
They got it completely outmaneuvered here.
Yeah.
I don't know when they knew it, how serious the unionization effort was, what the timing was going to be, but they dropped it shortly after a new CBA was ratified. So they can't take it out on the major league players for another 4 years or so. They have, they're staring down the barrel of a judiciary committee hearing, a bipartisan one at that, looking at their antitrust exemption. And look, you know, I think we disagree on how much of a factor this was, but it's certainly
I'm just unsure. I think you think it's a big factor. I'm not sure, but I could see it. I could definitely see it.
They don't like that kind of scrutiny from the public.
Yeah.
Generally speaking.
That's certainly true.
So it would be very difficult for them to do this kind of stuff in the shadows, really.
Yeah. So I guess my
kind of, that stuff being the kind of like union busting tactics.
I do think so. First of all, I think there's a significant shift, and it's been reported. I think we're at like a high since the 50s or 40s or whatever in terms of been public a,
whether it's minor league advocates or just better general baseball reporting on the issues in the minors. Yes. Like you again, yes. As I said when this first announced, you cannot frame this as millionaires versus billionaires. These guys are making like $700 a month, and I'm going to pay for a spread. Like clubhouse fees out of that. Rob
tried to do that anyway.
Yeah, yes, he sure did.
It went over like a lead balloon. And I do think the reporting environment matters. I think the media environment matters. I think social media matters.
They know their usual playbook on this kind of stuff will not work anymore.
And I think they've maybe accepted that after the last.
They may still be absolute shit heels when it comes to bargaining with this group. They will. I would expect. Yes.
Like, but let's not. When we say like boxed in or out, yeah, outfoxed or outmaneuvered or whatever, that doesn't change that they're going to be hardliners and pains in the asses about a CBA. Mm-hmm. But I think in this instance, their only move was essentially to drag things out, which I still am surprised they did not do, to be clear. But like, I do think someone, whether it was Manfred or Halem or someone in that room said, there's no benefit. Like, you are going to incur lots of costs and
this was going to be every question at his, like, because usually does a presser during the playoffs and the World Series. This is going to go through the owners meetings and the winner meetings if they tried to drag it out. It was going to be the story, and now it's not the story.
Yeah. Right. And I do think to go back to the kind of political angle of it, I do think the Senate stuff, the judiciary inquiries matter. I'm unsure how much. And I agree.
They were specifically targeting minor league stuff in this.
They were
the letters they sent. So you're
they have to answer a lot of questions. Minor league advocates. That's a right. Yeah. I mean, this certainly was targeted. And I do think the league wanted to avoid that. And so I do think it's a factor. I guess my thought was like, they've had their antitrust exemption kind of threatened by Congress before. Mm-hmm. It's never really come to anything.
Sure. I don't think they were worried about losing the antitrust exemption. I think it was just, 2 days of,
they don't want to be Rob
Manfred looks like an idiot. Yeah.
I think that's completely,
because he can't, like, if he gives that quote, like, we're paying them a living wage to a bunch of assembled beat reporters.
I reject the assertion that they're not paid.
He says that to Bernie Sanders, that's going to be a different, he's going to have some follow-up questions, right? That maybe the assembled throng of the baseball media didn't.
Right. Right. So MLB, they said pending a card check, I believe, which happens tomorrow, is my understanding.
This is just like a procedural thing as far as I can tell.
The other thing I thought they were going to be, as you put it, shit heels about is who constituted the bargaining unit. And I thought they might try and drive a wedge in at the full season versus complex league level. Mm-hmm. They did not.
No.
This is going to be a union from AAA all the way down to the U.S. complexes. It does not include the Dominican complexes. I think there are a variety of reasons for that.
It gets it gets significantly more complicated, I think, in terms of whether they're U.S. employees,
whether they're U.S. employees, right, domestic employees who are spending time over there, or if they are international, right. There are a lot of complications to it.
And,
you might find them reason to exclude them or not, but that is likely the reason.
Right. Exactly. And teams use that to create also like tax havens for their high bonus guys in a lot of cases too.
So. Absolutely. Absolutely. So, So my point, I guess, is that they did not kind of quibble over the bargaining unit as I thought they might have to make this more complicated. I think that's another win for the players, for the minor league players, for the potential union. I think this is certainly very exciting. And again, they're going to do a card check tomorrow. I think it will not be close. Again, I generally, from my understanding of talking to people who have gone through organizing processes at their workplace and things like that, like when MLB, or sorry, when the MLBPA announced that they had the 50% plus one to ask for formal recognition, that you don't do that unless you have way more than that. And so likely 60% or more had responded that they were interested in unionizing the miners. So I don't think the card check is essentially a formality. And I think some people originally when MLB said like, oh, pending a card check, they thought, oh, there's the catch. This is very standard.
Yep.
A third party will conduct it, possibly someone from the National Labor Relations Board, but it doesn't have to be. But yeah. So the question at this point, Jeff, is what now?
I mean, they enter negotiations for a CBA between the minor league players and the league.
Right. And I think that will be headed up largely by minor league, the group that was formerly minor league advocates.
Yep.
Obviously with the benefit of the wider MLBPA and the AFL-CIO, which they are now a part of, and they get to draw upon that experience and those resources. So yeah, I mean, we'll see what that negotiation brings. I expect it'll bring a lot of disagreement and, mm-hmm. and fodder, I'm sure, for us to talk about. I do not expect the owners to be much or very forgiving on this front. But I also do think like there's going to be room. There's a lot of room for vast improvement that doesn't actually cost the owners that much, which we've all been kind of yelling about for a long time. So I do wonder kind of how contentious they're going to be, because as you said, like from a public relations standpoint, it is not millionaires versus billionaires. It is like living wage stuff. And if they go hard on that, it's going to look really, really bad.
Yep.
I don't know if they care if it looks really, really bad. Like, I suspect Jerry Reinsdorf does not, but you never know, I guess. And I think it's at least a much harder, it's a much harder position to defend and come out looking well in the public eye, I guess is how I'd say.
Yeah.
One last thing to discuss. It is not about the minor league unionization effort, but two prospects are suing the Los Angeles Angels in the Dominican Republic for reaching verbal agreements and then backing out of them. I thought this was really interesting, and it seems like they have a very strong case from the report.
I don't know enough about the contract law in the Dominican Republic.
Right. Yeah. So certainly I also don't really know enough, but from the way it was phrased in the report,
isn't there like video of a text, like someone,
yes, the there's like video signed, you know, essentially of a verbal agreement, and verbal agreements have a mm-hmm. lot more weight in Dominican law than they do in US law is essentially how it's phrased. And there is video of that. Now, the interesting part to me that I haven't seen anyone address is this. Those agreements happened under the Billy Epler regime. Yes. in Anaheim, I'm just going to say, rather, so not to confuse with the yeah. Dodgers, who have likely committed other violations. But the backing out or the reneging occurred when Perry Manassian took over. And I don't know if the organization is responsible for the agreement, the verbal, like, is a verbal agreement between the organization?
With
the,
you would think it was with the team, people? Not with the.
I agree. That's my like that's my assumption.
Functionally, that's, Billy Epler is just a senior vice president for a company.
Right. And that is my assumption. But again, I don't really know Dominican law, and I don't know if it matters if there is a regime, if a whole new group of people are in place. Does the agreement you had with someone? No, I agree. They're representative.
I assume
of
this
the organization
gets settled with a very large amount of money and a very strong NDA. So they do not want a precedent on the books here, because all the teams do this to an extent at various times.
Yeah, I just think I don't know. It was just an interesting aspect to it. I agree. I would argue, and my assumption is that these guys are representatives of the org, and that the org is still responsible for that. Now, the other interesting part to me is as you said, like, this will probably get settled, and I think the league would really like it to get settled, because a lot of these teams are doing this.
Yes.
They are backing it. Now, the question is, can you always get proof of, you know, like them on video saying you have a deal? But regardless, a lot of teams back out of these deals. Sometimes it's related to a physical. Sometimes it's related to, you know, whatever. But you know, based on Passan's report, it's basically like both of these guys didn't have any physical issues, didn't like stop training, stop working out or anything like that. Like, they didn't. Legitimately nothing happened, except I guess someone new came along and said, yeah, we're actually not doing that. And I will note that the players are Willie Fanyas and Caterson Pavone.
Yeah. Fanyas ended up with the Mets after Epler took over. I think got pretty decent money in the end.
I think he got $1.5 million. He had originally agreed to $1.8 million per the court filings. With the Angels, he got, I think, 1.5, which is it's obviously less. So I'm not saying there's no damages, but for someone, I believe it was 18 when he signed with the Mets, that's a substantial amount for someone at 18. Teams tend to discount quote unquote older players pretty heavily.
It was Pavone that agreed to 1.8 million when he was 14. Fanyas was 425,000.
Okay, I have the exact opposite from ESPN's report, but I don't.
Okay, well, that's fine. I went to Bleacher Report, so
yeah,
take those sources for what you will.
Passan says Fanyas for $1.8 million.
That makes more sense. Yes.
Yeah. So I think that's right, but you know, either way, this is a widespread practice. Especially since, and we've talked about this, but like the league,
there was a USA Today article about this too, with regards to the Padres, I believe, from a few years ago.
And the league only made it worse with these, with the hard caps that they instituted. Teams started slotting out these agreements years and years in advance. They were always ahead of time and not legal, but I think it only got worse. And then again, these guys, a lot of times they stop doing showcases or do very few showcases because they are already technically, or maybe not technically, whatever, they've agreed to a deal. So then, you know, when they get kind of released back into the open, into free quote unquote free agency, A, clubs have very, very limited money to spend, and B, they haven't seen them perform for years. Right. Which gives, you know, even if you do showcases now, teams like to track that progression, and like to know kind of what the trend is, what where you're coming from, and that informs to some degree where you're going. So yeah, I think, I don't know, I would, like you said, expect a settlement, but I'm very interested to see kind of how this goes, because I think it could have a relatively big impact. Is that fair to say from your point of view?
Yeah. We also might just never hear anything about it, and it'll get dumped in a notes column that it got settled at some point. So
yeah, fair enough. But I will be interested to see how it plays out, and I'll be trying to keep an eye on that. Why don't we take a break, and we'll be back with our last three topics. We're back with episode 240 of Five and Dive, our third topic of the show. Playoffs. I can't do it.
Yeah, it wasn't bad. You gave it a good effort, at least.
I gave it a go. Yeah, we B for effort. the Easts are getting interesting. The East divisions. Would you like to start AL or NL?
Because we are a Mets podcast, Craig. We can.
Yeah, sure. I figured.
Yeah.
Or as someone recently said, like, every podcast just slowly turns into a
I think it was Bauman.
I think you said that. The Braves currently sit a game and a half back of the Mets. They had briefly taken sole possession of first place
by a half game, yeah.
For the first time this season?
I'd have to go back. I don't remember April that well. Close. Yeah, sure. Close enough. Been a long time.
The Braves, the Mets owe Seattle a little bit for their current standing as a game and a half up. I know they made it more interesting on Sunday night than anyone would like.
Yeah.
But Seattle continues to play very, very well. And we got another, I guess, marquee moment from Julio Rodriguez.
Yeah.
And I wrote about this for Box Score Banner, but two home runs from Julio Rodriguez on Sunday night, two home runs from Michael Harris. A lot of fun from, I would argue, the two front runners for Rookie of the Year, although yes, Spencer Strider
might,
and Adley
Rutschman. This might not have been the best half season of Michael Harris's career because he just keeps going.
He just keeps going. Fair enough. And I think it's him or Spencer Strider for NL Rookie of the Year. I think it's Julio or Adley. I would go Julio. I think he had the benefit of more playing time, whatever.
Sure.
But you know, you can say the front runners if you prefer one of these other players that, you know, fine. I'm not trying to offend anyone. But what a display. I mean, it's just a really great display of talent.
17-degree launch angle, 117 miles an hour off the bat. That's just,
yeah, that's not normal. Giancarlo Stanton stuff. Yeah. He's an absolute freak in the best possible way. Obviously, there was a bit of a meltdown from Diego Castillo and, you know, a little bit from Paul Sewald there. But the Mariners pulled it out. They gave the Mets some breathing room. The Braves have lost three in a row, but before that had won seven in a row.
Yes.
So it's just a little bit of this back and forth. Kind of they've been this hot and cold team all year. The Mets are hanging on. The
Mets had a very annoying game against the Marlins last night, as they often do. Or the Cubs, right. Sorry.
Very Cubs, I was going to say, I thought it was the Cubs, yeah. But yeah, they got a nice start from Carlos Carrasco over the weekend. Taijuan Walker had a very nice start on Sunday. Again, it was the Marlins on Sunday. So you take a little bit away, but 10 strikeouts. He hadn't done that in quite a while. Seven innings. He hadn't done that in quite a while.
They got Jacob DeGrom going today, which always helps.
Right. I was going to say just a little bit of help behind DeGrom and Scherzer when he's healthy. Bassett's been very steady all year. I know he had a rough start recently, but has mostly been steady all year. But it helps to see those other guys kind of pitching in with quality efforts, even if it's not dominance. Walker's was quite dominant. I don't know. How comfortable are you as a Mets?
More so when they're up one and a half than when they're down half
a game. Down half a game? Yeah. Sure.
You're starting to see, I think, the benefits of the schedule difference. The Mets aren't exactly putting the stamp down on the division in these series with the, you know, whatever. They win the next two against the Cubs. They 2-3 against the Marlins, 2-3 against Pittsburgh, 2-3 against the Cubs. You'd like them to sweep one or more of these series against really bad teams just because Atlanta was able to do that for like 3 months straight, it felt like.
Yes. But, you know, and certainly since August, like what we talked about, since August 7th, they were like some insane.
Yeah. Atlanta, record. You know, Atlanta's had their own little three-game losing streak in here. Like this stuff happens. I think it's gonna go. I don't know if back and forth, but it's gonna tighten. You know, maybe they end up 2.5 or 3.5 up at some point. Maybe Atlanta gets it back to 1 or 2 by the time they play each other last week of the season. I think we're gonna be a Mets podcast for a little bit longer, at least an NL East one.
Yeah, I agree. Do you think, as currently constituted, there's much difference between the two teams?
No, I mean, I didn't think so last week. I don't think so now, basically.
Yeah. Okay. Just checking in. Atlanta is playing San Francisco right now. San Francisco edged out a one run victory yesterday after the Mets, as Jeff mentioned, lost to the Cubs, disappointingly. In the AL East, it looked like Tampa was going to close the gap a little bit, as we talked about last week heading into the weekend. They won, Tampa won on Friday and the Yankees just did not look good. The Yankees responded with two thorough smackdowns on Saturday and Sunday. The gap was stretched to, I think, 4.5 heading out of Sunday. Tampa lost to Toronto yesterday.
So Toronto's 5.5 back and Tampa's 6 back at the moment.
6 back. Right. And Toronto now, in light of that, leads the wild card race. They are the wild card one right now. They are 8-2 in their last 10. Bo Bichette, as we discussed, has come alive. He has continued to come alive. He was the difference yesterday. He drove in all 3 runs for Toronto in their victory 3-2 win over Tampa. He had an 8th inning home run with a very exquisite finish on that one. The Yankees,
as I noted on Twitter, it looked like he let go with one hand as he was loading the bat.
Yeah, I mean, it was his classic all out swing. He's just had a monster. I don't know if you pulled like his August and especially his September has been incredible, as we talked about.
September is 5/11, 5/49, 11/28.
Which, like, it's like, oh, we're early in September. It's the 13th.
We're 11 games.
We're 12 days in. It's not nothing to hit 500 over that period. It happens. I'm not saying it doesn't, but, like, it is crazy. The Yankees, the pitching has been better of late. The lineup, still concerning, I would say. Stanton is back in the lineup, has been terrible since returning from the IL. It really is kind of just the Aaron Judge show. Mm-hmm. He's up to, what, 56 home runs?
I believe so, yeah.
Is he going to break 61?
Maybe.
Better than even chance at this point.
I think he does now, yeah. Because he's just, I mean, I think he already did this last week, but he's capable of just having like 3 home runs in 4 games. And all of a sudden you look up and like, oh, he's most of the way there. And they still have 20 games left. Yeah.
I think he had hit 9 home runs in his last 13 games or something like that at one point in the last few days, which is bananas. Unless you are either, I guess, Albert Pujols or Mike Trout. Yeah. Mike Trout has homered in 7 straight. So, but yeah, look, the Yankees are safe, I think, at 5.5. Look, the Jays are very hot. They're finally playing a bit more like the team I think we all expected coming into this year. Jose Berríos had a decent start yesterday. We talked about him a little bit last time. But yeah, I mean, I think it really comes down to the lineup and whether, you know, Bo and Vlad and Springer and Teoscar are going to hit like we know they can. Anything else on the AL East you want to note?
No.
Okay.
I will just point Bo is now top 30 by F4 in baseball for position players after having a down season really until about 2 weeks ago.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those ones where it's like it's a down season, but is it?
Yeah, I mean, you know what I mean? It isn't like, now, certainly.
Right. He is not that high on BP's warp, I should note, but yeah.
The defensive metrics are all over the place on him, as we noted.
Yes, and we've talked about FRAA before, so it's not. He is top 50 though per BP's warp. He's 2.7 wins. I think BP's warp is generally not as high overall as Fangraphs,
right? Different or replacement level. Yeah.
Either way, right? Different replacement level. So, anyway, that aside, the AL Central, we have to talk about it.
Do we?
It's a race. It's a race.
I literally wrote here: the AL Central is a division that exists.
It is the Guardians. They keep on keeping on whatever they're doing, and no one else can catch them. It's not because they're great. They are 74-65. That's fine. That would be good for fourth place, barely ahead of the Orioles in the AL East. The White Sox are 72-69. They have been much better with Miguel Cairo at the helm, I would note. They are 3 back of the Guardians. Do you want to make any predictions on this race?
I think Cleveland's going to win it.
Yeah, I think that's I think that's the reasonable thing. But I also will point out, like 2 weeks ago, I said, I think the White Sox have a pretty good chance, actually. Tim Anderson got hurt later that day, which was bad. I just need to point out Elvis Andrews, who they picked up after Oakland released him just to avoid him picking up a vesting option in his contract, since arriving in Chicago, is hitting 293, 337, 511.
That's good.
Elvis Andrews is slugging
Andrews, yeah.
511.
Good park to hit.
It is a good park to hit, but that's still bananas to me. Tim Anderson will be back soon, I think. And it sounds like Andrews is willing to play wherever. They should absolutely play him at second base or Anderson, whatever. They should be playing both of them. I think there's a reasonable chance. I mean, three games isn't so bad at this point, given that Cleveland isn't that good, right? Like, it kind of sounds like on one level, we're saying 5.5 games for the Yankees is very likely to be insurmountable for the Rays or the Jays. And I'm saying three, like it's 2.5 games or whatever. It's not that big a deal, but at the same time, like the Yankees are actually not that bad and Cleveland's really not very good.
Right.
So that's kind of the difference. The Guardians and White Sox do play directly this week on Thursday. They have a noon makeup game, just a one-game series. And then I'm trying to see, do they play in October? No. So that's all they have head-to-head, White Sox and Cleveland. They have four games left. They have a midweek series next week. So, yeah, I mean, within the number of games that they play over the rest of the season, I think we have a shot. In the wild card, this is mostly set at this point on each side. I mean, the Orioles are 5.5 back of Tampa now. I said the Jays were in the top spot. They're tied with the Mariners. I should have noted for the top spot in the wild card. Orioles are quite a bit back. Milwaukee is 2 back of the Padres. I guess they're not that set. It just feels like Milwaukee has just been floundering for a month at this point.
I mean, they have.
Yeah. I guess the thing is same is true of San Diego, I suppose. I guess is the argument. I don't know. I think San Diego holds on to that.
Yeah, they're kind of a mess too, though.
They are a mess. This is a lot like last year for them, don't you think?
Yeah, I mean, they're less of a mess, I suppose. I mean, like, look, I think they have ruined the vibes by optioning Nabil Chrismont, so.
Thank you. Thank you for making it about Nabil Chrismont. Yeah, I don't know. I did think it was an interesting piece. Rob Maines had a piece today at BP basically about like which games do you need to win? Do you need to win the games against the bad teams, or does it say more if you're winning games against the good teams? He noted that if Milwaukee had St. Louis's record against bad teams, like sub 500 teams, they'd only be a game back of St. Louis. They are significantly more. I think they're 8 games back at this point. So it's a big, they've just really underperformed, but he basically said that, you know, in that study, that it doesn't matter one way or the other. You just have to win games. Okay, so let's go around the horn in our fourth segment. We got a retraction. Doug Gottlieb retracted his statement about Casey Close kind of failing to live up to the basic tasks of an agent for Freddie Freeman when it comes to his offseason deal with the Dodgers and not signing in Atlanta. Yes. I really, really enjoyed that Casey Close sued him over this.
I am not a lawyer. I am not a legal reporter. I have never taken a law class in my life. I'm pretty sure, reading between the lines here, his legal advice was, you're fucked. Just settle it.
Yeah, I did.
Write whatever they tell you to write and put it on Twitter.
I don't have, I'm trying to find and go back. Of course, he tweets a lot, but if that's not the pot calling the kettle black from coming from me, but like he
better off just searching for like the pass and retweet of it, probably could you find it faster.
But yeah, regardless, like he said, he basically his reasoning on this was that on the like on the advice of counsel or whatever, or it was like in light of a lawsuit. Okay, I got it. Upon further vetting of my sources, a review of the lawsuit filed against me in this matter, and a direct conversation with Casey himself, I have learned that the conduct I allege did not occur, and that there is no credible basis for stating that it did.
Yeah,
I think so. It's basically like he talked to his source, and his source said, "You're fucked."
Yeah.
And then he reviewed the lawsuit filed against him in this matter.
And his lawyer said, "You're fucked.
You're fucked." And then a direct conversation with Casey Close himself. And he said, "Doug, you're fucked." and he said, like, "I have learned the conduct did not occur." I really love a review of the lawsuit. Oh, there was a lawsuit filed against me. Okay.
Yeah. This changes. Some new shit has come to light.
Yeah. That is exactly what it is. New shit has come to light.
I didn't know you were going to sue me over that.
Well, and I think that's generally a safe assumption. But the thing is, the difference is that what Doug Gottlieb tweeted out and said was legitimately harmful.
Yes.
To Casey Close's business interests.
Right.
And he essentially alleged that he failed to uphold a necessary requirement of being an agent in this case. And if Casey Close let that stand, players are going to say, like, what the fuck? Why is this happening? Like, I can't trust you if you let that say. I earnestly don't think he had much of a choice if Gottlieb wasn't going to retract without the lawsuit.
Right.
And you know, on Close's side, like, he's taken the retraction, and he's not trying to get damages. He's just like, just retract it because it was not true. And I think he basically had enough to prove that clearly by reviewing the lawsuit filed against Gottlieb. So anyway, I think a very pleasing close to that saga. James Karinchak had his hair gently stroked by an umpire. Look, I've already forgotten which manager. Was it Baldelli?
It was Baldelli, yeah.
Yeah, Baldelli asked him to check it. Karinchak goes to his hair after every single pitch. Yeah. He was a massive either spider tack or whatever other sticky stuff.
You can just go look at his
spin rate
the last 2 years.
It drops off the table. It has come back to a substantial degree. Do a lot of guys go to their hair to get sweat and then mix it with some rosin to get some sort of grip? Absolutely. Do they all get checks like this? No. Do they all have Karinchak's history of massive spin rate that absolutely cratered and has now come back? No, they do not. I have no problem with Rocco Baldelli asking for this. They didn't find anything.
I would assume he's probably smart enough not to keep it in his hair.
Right. I might assume it's coming from, well, it's either somewhere else or it's like the catcher's got something. Who knows, right? Yeah. Like other guys, all you need is a little bit. It wasn't there. I think it's fine to move on. But if you had to pick one person, this like probably should happen to in terms of getting an extra check, it's probably the right guy.
It could be a little mind game aspect to it too. He didn't know if he's gonna find anything, try to get him off his game. He's a little bit of a weirdo.
Yes. Yeah. He's a little bit of a head case. Absolutely. I don't really have any other commentary on it. I think it's fine. Like, it's fine. They checked it. They found nothing. So be it. We got to see an umpire run his hand through a player's hair on the field. It's like, you know, a little entertainment for everybody.
Yeah.
Not entertaining, the Detroit Tigers offense.
No.
They have been shut out 21 times.
That is like once a week, basically.
That's a lot. I don't know what the record is. I don't know. It's a lot. This is not a good offensive team. I would point out that the Tigers, this just to be mean, the Tigers traded Trace Thompson, who has like a 146 OPS plus with the Dodgers, for nothing, literally for like cash considerations. So yeah, they're hurting on the offense. Look, Spencer Torkelson has been really, really, really bad. He's been better since coming up from the minors. I know he didn't really have results, but like yesterday, I think he had four balls over 100 something miles per hour. He's hitting the ball harder. That's good process. Seems like he's been better. Riley Green, I think, has been okay. I don't know that there's much else to speak of.
He is hitting 257, 319, 370. Right, it's been very average, right?
Yeah. It's not good. So
it's not good, but it's like for a guy making his
21 debut, with swing and miss issues.
Yeah, it's not the. I don't think it's indicative.
It's not a disaster.
One way or the other, right? It's not a disaster.
No, I agree. I agree.
I will point out
John
Scope
has been atrocious.
Nobody with more. Okay, exactly one player with more than 300 plate appearances for this team has an OPS that starts with a 7. There are, however, three that start with a 5.
That's not great. Yeah, and that is Eric Haas, right?
I'm assuming it is Eric Haas. Yes.
He, who is their backup catcher, so that's great.
I think he DHs some too, but yeah.
Yeah, yeah, I think he does.
I mean, wouldn't he?
He has more plate appearances than their starting catcher. I think Barnhart was hurt for a little bit, but yeah, it's not a good situation. They've called Ryan Kreidler up. They've called Kerry Carpenter up. These are not anyone changing the fortunes of this team. Are they anything at all?
I've sort of liked Ryan Kreidler in the past. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I think he's a 4. So.
Okay. So sure.
Yeah.
He'll spend time in the majors.
He certainly sure will.
Yeah, I don't know. I have nothing. I got this. This is depressing. This might be the most depressing team in the majors.
Yeah.
Like I know Oakland is awful and they're awful on purpose. This was supposed to be a team coming out of their rebuild.
Yep.
Not good. Not good. Albert Pujols has fourth place on the all-time list by himself. He stroked home run 697. As I said in my box score banner, milestone watch, son of a bitch is going to do it.
He's going to do it.
I mean, he's going to do it. Unless he has, I think he even stalled out at 599. He stalled out for quite a while.
Yeah.
I think before he got to 600. Unless he has that go on, it's three home runs. He's going to get to 700.
Yeah.
And I think that's great. I love that he's having this miraculous walk-off season and a return to St. Louis. I will note, while we're on Pujols in St. Louis, like this is a fun kind of walk-off season for Wainwright, for Pujols, for Molina. Did you see the breaking news as it regards to World Baseball Classic drama? That Eduardo Perez has resigned as Puerto Rico's general manager. He resigned yesterday. So that's not breaking news. He resigned last night. But the reason, supposedly, this is per Jorge Castillo of the LA Times, is because the president of Puerto Rico's Baseball Federation gave Yadier Molina the managerial job without telling Eduardo.
There's like always, like, I feel like there was like weird politics around the Venezuelan team too last time around.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I don't, like, obviously.
It's a little early. I feel
I
like.
Yes, I suppose, yeah.
That, like, Team USA is still rolling individual announcements of who's on the team. So,
yeah.
Apparently Perez wanted Joe Espada as the manager.
Sure.
Seems reasonable. Yeah. But yeah. So Yadier Molina, you can't question his dedication as a manager in the sense that he took a weekend off from the Cardinals to go watch his basketball team play in the championship.
Yeah.
God, I love baseball sometimes. All right. I don't know. Do you have any other thoughts on Pujols and his?
No, I did see that Wainwright and Molina are going to break the battery record.
Yes, I think tomorrow.
Today or tomorrow, I think Wainwright pitches. Yeah.
Very cool. I mean, like, sure. That's what you don't see. Shit, like, you don't see a catcher and a pitcher play that long, especially for the same team, or at least the same teams theoretically, to do this kind of thing anymore. It's
Really looking forward as a Mets fan to one more playoff series against the Wainwright Pujols and Yadier Molina.
Yeah, no, I've like gone all the way around the bend. I was so sick of these guys, whatever. I legitimately think it's cool that quote unquote modern, it's like 19 years each for Wainwright and Molina, but like that, I think it's really cool. And I would say, I would have probably said it could never happen in today's game that someone would break kind of one of these older records where guys stayed on the same team forever.
Right, right.
Especially the wear and tear on pitchers, the wear and tear on catchers. Like, it just is, it's not something I would have foreseen. And I think it's pretty cool. All right. You're annoyed at how long I've taken, and I apologize for that. What to watch, Jeff? Close us out.
I guess Padres Mariners probably has the most implication here, given where the Padres are. Actually, clearly fighting for a spot. Logan Gilbert against Yu Darvish today. Luis Castillo throws tomorrow against Mike Clevenger, I believe. So pretty good pitching matchups there.
I gotta say, Luis Castillo in Seattle is just such a good fit. It's a good fit. I liked that.
They've needed a top line. Obviously, you know, Gilbert and George Kirby.
Kirby has been really good this year.
But you do kind of want that. He is a good fit. It's just that they needed that sort of. We can argue if Castillo's an ace or not, or if he's like.
But I'm not going to get into that. He's a frontline guy. And look, I know they gave up a lot and all of that kind of stuff. But like again, I it's just such a good fit of what they needed and what it did for their rotation, knocking everyone back up, you know, a slot. I just really like that. He's been great there, and it's been fun to see. Sorry, I'm interrupting.
Yeah. Conversely, the other team in that. I don't know if it's actually a two-team-for-one spot race, but the Brewers are facing the Cardinals this week. We mentioned the Wainwright Yadi game on Wednesday, and we're going against Corbin Burns. So pretty good.
Right, so that'll be the record-breaking start.
Contrast in styles, certainly.
Yeah, just a little bit. Okay, and then you mentioned Rays Jays. Obviously, a lot of playoff implications around that.
Yeah, and you will see how the Braves do against the Giants. A couple more games there, too, to try to narrow or at least hold the margin at 1.5 in the NL East.
All right. Well, I think that'll do it, Jeffrey. I know I've taken up enough of your time and our listeners' time. So thank you for co-hosting this episode. Thank you to our listeners for tuning in to another episode of Five and Dive, brought to you by the Baseball Perspectives Podcast Network and our Patreon supporters. You can support the Patreon at patreon.com/fiveanddive. You can get in touch with the show at fiveanddive@baseballperspectives.com. We are wherever you get your podcasts. Just search for Baseball Perspectives Podcast Network, and we'll be in that feed. I've also been trying to post our episodes on the site. You can listen directly off a webpage if that is your preference. But thank you again for tuning in, and we will see you later this week.